Hey, I'm just letting you know that in February 2023, I am speaking at my friend Andy Storch's event in Sonoma, California. It's called the Talent Development Think Tank. I'll be running a session on marketing your workshops. And on day three, I'll be hosting the 2-hour workshop blueprint session. I'd love to see you there. Head on over to leannehughes.com/thinktank. Enjoy the episode. Coming up next on Leanne Hughes's Work and Live Large.
This quote comes from my mother. And this is all about being grounded. And so her quote to me as a kid and continues now, and she's in her 80s, is never judge a day at lunchtime.
Oh.
So I'd come home and say, hey, it's amazing. I got made a prefect or I've won the first 15 or whatever. And she'd say, that's good. But hey, never judge a day at lunchtime.
Oh my gosh.
Life's too short. You're here to work and live large. Here's your host with nothing to lose, Leanne Hughes.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm your host, Leanne Hughes, and I'm here to help you imagine what's possible is possible for you. Hey, I'm really excited about sharing today's conversation with the author of the book Belonging, The Ancient Code of Togetherness. The author is Owen Eastwood, and honestly, I love this book. I have shared it with so many people, a lot of leadership teams. Just it's all about creating a really powerful and high-performing team, as well as company cultures based on creating a sense of belonging. I'm not sure about you, but I've definitely been in work situations where I might have started in a company and I just didn't feel like I belonged and created a lot of tension and stress. I could remember walking into a building and feeling it in my stomach. And so the book about belonging is really about how do you sort of accelerate that trust and help people feel like they belong from the moment they begin. He gives some great examples of one of my favorite footballers, Michael Owen from Liverpool, just sharing his examples of going to high-performing teams, like in theory, but how Michael felt when he joined these teams. It's a really powerful behind-the-scenes insight. So in the book Belonging, Owen reveals for the first time the ethos that made him one of the most in-demand performance coaches in the world. He also draws on his own Maori ancestry and weaves together insights from our evolutionary story and our collective wisdom. Owen shines a light on where these powerful ideas are applied around the world in high-performing settings, encompassing sport, business, the arts, and military. He also shares a concept called whakapapa, which is spelled W-H-A-K-A-P-A-P-A, which is a Maori idea that embodies our universal human need to belong, and it really represents a spiritual belief that is unbreakable. And Owen in this interview shares a bit about that in this conversation. You'll also hear, I have to start off by asking him how he felt when he was called in to create an intervention for the South African cricket team. We talk about us and them within organizations and how we can create a collective feeling of belonging. He also, what I love is he also dispels the myth that we all as individuals need a purpose. We talk about the impact of environment and how that affects your ability to be resilient and to feel like you belong, as well as our central nervous system. We're just exploring ideas around just paying attention to the cues that our body gives us. And of course, we got the rapid round at the end. So Owen has worked for the England football team and the British Olympic team. He also has stories to share from his world of the command group of NATO, professional ballet, corporate leadership teams. So cool, such a wide variety of experiences and this theory of belonging, how it underpins all of it because we are human beings. I love his pragmatic approach to this and his ability to simplify things and really think about what is required here to create high performance. Show notes for this one are over at podcast.leannehughes.com. You can also connect with Owen on LinkedIn. That's how I connected him. And of course, a link to his book will be in the show notes as well. So much to dig in. I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I was thrilled to have it with Owen. Enjoy the show. Owen Eastwood, it's so delightful to have you on the podcast. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for being so kind and reaching out to me last year and then keeping in touch and inviting me today.
Of course. Yes, I've got your book right here. Actually, it's my dad's copy of the book. So he heard an interview with you, and I basically do that a lot. I steal a lot of his business books and just forget to return them. So I said I would after this interview, but I have bought a few copies. Oh, and I'm really interested. Prior to this podcast, I had a whole podcast about facilitation and running workshops. And I was reading your book, and I want to cast listeners back to winter 2010. You're working with the South African national cricket team, the Proteas, and you're brought in to create an intervention at a camp. So I was wondering if you could just share a bit of that story with listeners, but also, like, how were you feeling? This is a big team here that you've been brought in to affect change. What was your sort of thought process before going to camp?
Well, the honest answer would be panic, probably. We talk about facilitation. I never facilitated anything like that before. And I'm not trained in that. My background was as a lawyer. I sort of accidentally got into the performance coaching space. But the context there was a team which had an abundance of talent that reached the world number one 3 times in the previous 10 years. So they had great talent. But each time they'd become world number one, they lost the ranking within a couple of months. So they couldn't sustain it. So I think this is probably a situation a lot of people can relate to. You got awesome talent and you have your good days and you do some cool things, but actually you don't really sustain it. You're inconsistent and you don't take all the opportunities that come your way, and it ultimately can become frustrating. So they'd tried different things tactically, technically, et cetera, and then ultimately they decided to get someone to look at the team culture, and then I was that person. And when we did a bit of a review, a bit of a survey before this camp, we saw that the culture was nice. It wasn't bullying or unpleasant or nasty or anything, but it was weak. That there was very directive. People did what they were told. There was very little relationships being built, even though they spend incredible amounts of time together. It was quite superficial. There was a lot of diversity in the team, most diverse team in world sport, but that hadn't been addressed in a way where people could actually get to see the human beside them. So people tended to operate in cliques around people they felt more comfortable with in their own background. So the culture was weak, and therefore once you achieve something like being world number one, there was a tendency for people to get a little bit selfish. So, okay, we're world number one, a bit more money around. Maybe I'm doing very well, so maybe a bit more opportunity for me personally. All these things started to kick in because all culture was a bit weak. And also they didn't have a higher purpose. They played in order to win games, but they hadn't articulated a higher purpose. So that was, in terms of facilitation, I'd hardly say it was a masterclass for me. But my approach, which is still the same today, is just simply what do they actually need? I don't come with a template or a methodology. I'm just trying to understand what do they need. And what they needed was first some brutal honesty around the environment and the culture and how it was not in any sense high performing. Secondly, they needed some work to be done about what is the higher purpose of South African cricket team, because they hadn't done that piece of work. Even though it might seem obvious from the outside, it wasn't obvious to them. So then we got some pretty cool people to come in, including people who'd been in Robben Island, and to try and help them explain what it means to represent South Africa. So that was, I think we did that over 2 or 3 days. It was very immersive and very, a lot of tears and a lot of laughs.
Wow. I mean, in facilitation, yeah, it's called like holding the space. And it's interesting that you talk about, I didn't have any methodology. I just knew that the brutal truth had to come out. And so I can imagine that, like you said, panic before, I had to giggle because I can imagine feeling exactly the same way. Even if I felt like I was prepared, you just cannot prepare for an experience like that. When you're talking about the brutal honesty, I mean, how did that sort of come out? Was it through the experience, the fact that you were in this beautiful location? Was it that the purpose that was set beforehand? What enabled that truth to come out in conversation?
Well, my approach, and I work with a mixture of sports teams and corporate teams, and I've worked in ballet, as you know, and I've worked with the NATO military command, so quite a diversity of work, but I always will do the same thing. So in terms of this brutal honesty I talk about, my approach is always the same, whether it's sporting teams, corporate teams, ballet, military, whatever. And that is, what I do is I will go deep with one-on-one interviews with, if possible, everyone, but if the teams and organizations are too big, then certainly a pool of maybe 20, 25 people. So what I am doing is spending an hour. I'm doing a big project at the moment with a film studio where we're in Los Angeles and London, and we nearly completed that process. I think we're up to number about 28. And we go quite deep into what they're experiencing, what they think is awesome, and what the things where they think are getting in their road. So keep it very simple. And then what I do always, and I did it with South African cricket team in that example, was I replay back to them their own words. This is not me saying, hey, this is your lucky day. I'm an expert on all this. Everyone should just shut up and listen to what I think. I never, ever would do that. What I say is I've had a chance to really connect with you and listen to you. And this is what you've told me. And they are the most brutal feedback you can get, because I will quote, I'll put on a screen or I'll share with them, this is your direct quote. And I only do that when there's themes around it. I don't, if one person out of 25 is making one comment, then I'll manage it differently probably, but I'm more interested in patterns and themes and strong insights. So that gets their attention because they are listening to themselves, although they haven't facilitated themselves. And for me, that I learned that very early on, that is the most effective way to ground and anchor the conversation.
Yeah, it's also like I've used that with groups as well. It's like they see themselves in the comments. And it's funny because when I was, again, my show was first time facilitator, but I actually learned that as I was learning more about teams and groups, it's actually to be about lazy facilitation and actually pulling back. And like you said, not being the expert, but feeding the information back to them and providing a forum where they see those comments. So it is actually quite strong. I've got to say though, like you're a lawyer, and here you are working with the South African cricket team. You mentioned some of your other clients before. Can you believe this is your life right now? Like working with these teams?
Yes, I can. I mean, it's a bit strange, but I don't know. Even when I was little, you just do things and then you do the next thing and then you do the next thing. And it doesn't seem, I mean, I can see why it would look like a sudden jump from being a lawyer to working in some of these environments, but no, not really. I feel like I'm the same person and I'm just, you know, definitely trying to get better at what I do. But yeah, it's just slowly evolving, and I'm quite excited by the fact that in 10 years' time I haven't got a clue what I'll be doing.
Yeah, that makes life really exciting. Hey, you spoke before about cliques within teams, within businesses as well, and you said you noticed a few different cliques within the South African team in terms of the different this was the English football team, different nationalities that were in the team together. I was sort of thinking about companies that I've worked with, and you go into an organization and it's like the cliques. And there's a sense of belonging within the cliques, but not overall. For example, like maintenance and production might clash, engineering and marketing might clash. They work for the same company. What's your advice, or what are your thoughts around creating a sense of belonging and connection for like the broader organization versus those in-groups?
Well, first of all, I don't get in a panic around cliques because there's a concept in nature called homophily, which is really reflects the fact that our need to belong, which is a fundamental hardwired behavior that we have, or a need that we have, means that we're always going to be seeking out the people we feel most comfortable and secure with. So when we're part of a team or a big organization, it's natural as part of our need to belong, the way it expresses itself, we're going to look for those people. So that's natural. That's fine. What I'm looking for from a performance point of view, whether it's actually holding back the performance of the team, their development. Now, that often actually does play out, because what's happening is the cliques are very, very tight, but then they don't build relationships. There's an opportunity cost. If you're going to spend an abundance of time in a clique, then the opportunity cost is that you're not building relationships elsewhere. So in a sporting team, a South African cricket team as an example, six different religions and cultures in that team, if you're just hanging out with other Afrikaans guys or other Muslims, then you are not building relationships. So therefore the opportunity for psychological safety is diminishing because you don't really know each other, or really, really trust each other. And your ability to challenge, your ability to bring ideas to the table, they might also be held back by the fact that it just is not a relational environment. So I don't freak out at cliques. And I don't like artificial things to stop them. Like some sports teams would say, when we have lunch, when we're on the bus, this is where you're going to sit in order to break it up. I really don't like that at all.
Yeah.
But I think what we need to do is be honest about it in the way that we feedback about where the culture's at, and then create natural opportunities where we commit some time to people outside of our cliques in order to get to know each other and build relationships.
Yeah. I agree with you about not trying to sort of just over manufacture these relationships and maybe create a yeah, a creative forum where it actually can happen more organically versus it not happening at all. It's a fine little balance between the intentionality versus it being organic. Now, you wrote this book, it went out last year in 2021, obviously mid-pandemic. A lot of what you talk about is connection to the history or connection to the region or the land or the family. And now we see organizations that have people like all around the world. Some people don't even know what their manager is like in person. Is it possible to create like a sense of belonging with people who are working remotely that you just don't see?
100%. And actually, I didn't answer your question perfectly last time because the thing I should have added was that what also will diminish the power of cliques is if we do have an overarching sense of purpose and identity for the whole team. When those things are not strong, then again, it pushes people into finding a bit of a sense of identity and purpose within a smaller group. So in terms of belonging, we need to make sure that across the whole team, the whole organisation, that we've got a strong story of this is who we are, this is what makes us different, this is what makes us special. Mm. Not necessarily better than anyone else, but this allows us to compete and this is why we want to compete. And yes, I use the Maori concept whakapapa, which was how I was brought up in terms of understanding the world, and that idea that each of us are part of an unbreakable chain of people that go all the way back in time to our first ancestors. Mm. Whether this is your family, your nation, your organisation, your school, whatever community you're part of, it's all the same idea of thinking about it. But also part of a line of people that goes into the future to the end of time, and our arms interlock with everyone before and after us. And the metaphor is the sun slowly moves. It started on our origin story, whatever that was, whenever that was, and slowly moves down. So the definition of a strong culture in that way is one where as the sun moves down the line of people, there is a transmission of who we are, what our purpose is, what our values are, what our rituals and traditions are. So there is a continuity and a sacredness about what came before. And then the sun's shining on us, so that's a present. So then what we do is we are very clear on what our own mission is, whatever that might be. And then the next part is the future, and that is when the sun's shining on us, we have to preview what our own legacy will be. Mm. And a fundamental aspect of that is making sure we create the conditions for the people who come after us to succeed. So for me, a belonging story needs to encapsulate where we come from, what we're doing together right now, and then what will be the future we navigate together, all of those things together. So I put quite a lot of effort in that. But, you know, sometimes it can be a startup, and I love that, because then we can curate the hell out of our origin story, and therefore, rather than just try and make a profit and have it in a shambolic way, with good and disastrous behaviours, we can actually curate an origin story to say, okay, we're going to try and achieve this, but we want to do it with these values being lived and this story evolving and this vision of what we're walking towards.
There's so much. There's like probably five different roads I want to go down after you've just mentioned that. I think the one that stuck out for me was what I love in your book. Here we go. I've got the quote here about purpose. You wrote, we should not feel inadequate if we don't have clarity of our purpose at an individual level. It's so interesting that you've said that, because because I'm a solopreneur now, I mean, prior to the last 3 years, I've been working in companies and I felt that the company is aligned with my purpose, which is why I've been there. But now that I'm on my own, I'm like, oh, I've got to create this purpose and meaning around what I do. And I'm really struggling with that. So to read that was actually quite reassuring for me. Owen, you're also a solo consultant. Do you have a purpose, or do you see it as more about providing a service to the teams that you work with?
I don't have a purpose, and I really don't. I know that it's the common narrative that every human being needs to have their own purpose, their own values, their own this, their own that. I don't believe that. And the reason I don't believe it is because traditional cultures, collectivist cultures, Asian, Polynesian, African, so getting away from the sort of modern Western democracies, they give us a huge hint at what our evolutionary story of Homo sapiens is, and that is that your life's meaning was interwoven with the groups you belong to. Mm. You know, if you're a hunter-gatherer, And it's a sort of a day-to-day season, the season existence. You know, the idea that you've got your own purpose and you're wandering around trying to achieve your full potential and self-fulfillment, all this is bollocks to me. The idea was actually we've got young people we need to take care of and protect. We've got old people we need to take care of. There's work to be done. There's food to be gathered. And there's survival. And all of these things are what mattered, not what your individual purpose was. And for a lot of, you know, like in the book, I interviewed Jerome Kino, double World Cup winning All Black, and we were talking about it. And I asked him actually that question. I said, you know, hey, by the way, can I just throw this at you? Have you got your purpose? And he said, I don't even know what that means. My purpose is my family, my culture, and the teams that I play for. And I feel exactly the same. So I don't have any purpose around my business. I enjoy it, and people ask me to help them. And that gives me a sense of, you know, motivation and purpose in the work. But no, I'm with you on that. I think what's dangerous is that people often then create something artificial in order to fill the gap when they're asked that question. Oh, you know, I want to do this and that. And I don't want people being under pressure to do that.
Exactly. And it feels just like kind of like a marketing. It feels inauthentic. And it's interesting because when I was working internally, one of my roles was actually flying to different weird operations in sort of Asian countries and India, and rolling out the whole Simon Sinek why thing and getting them to write their own personal why statement. And I was, like you said in your book, like I was greeted with blank. It was like, oh, I'm for my family, and I'm trying to dig into it. But then I realized what a cultural clash that was. And yeah, it is quite interesting. My mother's from Papua New Guinea. I went over there to play netball. And I remember at the end of the game, I went to sit with my family, and it's the first time I've ever sat in the circle. And I remember saying to them, oh, so what are we doing today? And they're like, you know, we're just here chatting. Like there was no plan. And it's so interesting when you go back to sort of the way it used to be and what we're like now. Like I had so much to learn just from that 5-minute question and that experience. So
picking up on that, you know, I see sports teams sometimes where the only time they meet is to do tactics and technical and train. Mm-hmm. They never create a space to actually just connect as human beings. And that's not in my, and same with working in corporate teams as well. That is not our story as Homo sapiens. That is not it. We have a campfire. In the night, in the evenings, we would always get together and talk and share and connect. And, you know, it would be a hormonal experience as well, with endorphins and oxytocin and dopamine would come from those experiences. So that's one of the things that I've enjoyed. The thing the football team I've been working with them for the last 6 or so years. And I love that. When we compete in tournaments, you know, time is made out just to sit around the fire and talk about what we're doing and how we and what we'd love and what our dreams are about how this could be great. And people think, oh, my God, that's amazing. And you know, so forward thinking. It's not forward thinking at all. It's going back 60,000 years into our history, and that's what we would naturally do. We've just lost our way.
We've totally lost our way. And do you know what was really interesting about that is how awkward I felt, because I was like, well, we've got to be doing something. Like I've got to fill this time. It's got to be meaningful. It's got to be value. And it's just such a way that I've been brought up, and it was such a striking contrast to what I was experiencing. But even with organizations, like sometimes I've been called in to, like, we want to help people connect and create conversations, but we're going to sit then in this room between 8 and 5 p.m. and we want content. It's like, well, if you really want that, why don't we just go to the beach? Like, do you really want connection? Like, we don't need to be in this room. But it just seems like, so I guess the question for you would be, if you're working with organizations, your approach is, like, how do you, your approach isn't about the KPIs and the metrics and the decimal points and driving, like, that's what I take from your book. But yet we're working in a structure, or companies work in that structure. So how do you influence them to try something a little bit different?
Well, I mean, I am a performance coach, so I wouldn't say I'm not interested in those things, but what I'm interested in is just making sure we're clear on a couple of things. What is that we're actually trying to achieve together? And I know that sounds a bit lame, but actually often people can't answer that. Like, they might have growth targets and all sorts of things, but that's not the same point. My starting point is getting a bit of clarity on what actually are we trying to achieve together. So what would success look like? And then the underlying question around why is this important? Which sort of that gets into your purpose. I mean, why do we want to do that? Mm. So if it's a national sports team, okay, so we want to win a World Cup. Okay, why do we want to do that? Because we want to inspire and unify our people. Okay, I get that. If it's a business, they might have some goals set. And then, okay, why do we want to do that? Because, you know, we are actually doing something very constructive for the people in our communities, for the economy, et cetera, and we want to sustain what we're doing. And at the moment, there's a question mark around that. So I want to understand that. The visioning is critical to me. Really got to, and I this is where talking about facilitation, but I will push hard on creating a really three-dimensional, deep visualization of what it is we're trying to achieve. And not the result, the outcome, but actually the bits and pieces that will get us there. So maybe 10% might be the ultimate outcome, but the rest of it would be how do we, what are the things we're doing? What does it look like? What's the environment we're creating? What type of people do we need here to achieve that? So yeah, I want them to articulate what it is they're trying to achieve, but then we have to go deep in the visioning of it because that's where all the clues exist as to how we want to take this forward and what we want to build together.
Mm, it sounds like curating a really great experience, but based on, and I really like that you said the 10% is actually the result, but it's more about the process and the experience to be had to sort of create that. Before
yeah,
we
can be quite,
yeah,
sorry, just on that, it can be quite technical, you know. Yeah, well, from a business point of view, they might say we want to have 15% growth, okay? Mm. Well, I can't visualize that, but what we can do is to say, is to use a visioning process to explain. So if we're going to do that, what are the bits of our business which are going to really, really ramp up, be successful? And what are the bits which won't contribute to that? So it becomes, you know, it's not just high level in the clouds. It actually becomes very strategic and it feeds into the strategy. Similarly, what's in our environment is enabling us to grow at that rate and what in our environment is disabling it from happening? Mm. So that are core questions I always ask. And I think I gave an example sometimes of an investment bank who had something like that. And they said, you know, one of our pillars is around being innovative. And then when I looked into the environment, you know, I saw that a new type of deal needed 12 levels of permission in order for it to be. So they weren't doing it. So their environment was disabling them from growing. So I'm, you know, it's starting big, but then getting quite specific about the things that we. And for a sports team, it might be when we break it down and visualize it, we actually find out that there's just a few core areas which we're really, really got to get better at rather than just the whole thing.
Yeah, but rather than a blanket approach. I love how that you spoke about environment or wrote about environment in your book and you mentioned sort of James Clear. I've been in team situations or I was working with a team, they were just completely in conflict and they had coaching and nothing worked. Then we moved offices and there was like more natural light coming in. The rooms were bigger. The ceiling was higher. This is like literally a very pragmatic example. And they just started getting along like within a couple of weeks. It was crazy. I'm pulling a real parallel here, but before we hit record, you spoke about the focus on what we think versus our central nervous system. I really have to ask you that before we duck off this call. It's not about your book, but I'm curious to hear your thoughts around this and what really impacts our ability to do things. I'll throw that open question.
Well, I'm just learning as I go, but I have been interested in the hormonal element of environments. Mm. And in the book Belonging, I do talk about that, how you can do certain things in an environment which will lead to higher levels of stress, hormones, cortisol, adrenaline, you know, being shouted at, being, you know, fearful, not feeling you belong. They will create that type of hormonal reaction. But similarly, you can do things in an environment, if it's well led and got a good culture, which is really surging the team by energizing them with dopamine, oxytocin, endorphins and things like that. So I think about it very biologically about what I am wanting the environment and the leadership to deliver. It's part of learning about that, and I don't have any background in any of this, obviously. I'm just sort of picking it up as I go along. But our central nervous system, you know, there's a lot of insights around maybe 80% of the information that we receive from around us through our senses, we aren't conscious of. And so actually, if you're feeling stressed, you feel very stressed right now, for me, what I've learned is not to slap on some false narrative that my brain's sort of offering, but actually just take it quietly and try and work out what it is that my central nervous system has decided to send some signals from my adrenal glands into my brain, what's going on. I'll give you an example. At the start of the year, I was working on a big project, which I really, really enjoying, and was going well. But after I had a week off, I kept waking up at about 3 o'clock in the morning worrying about this project, and I couldn't get back to sleep, which is very unlike me. And then this happened again and again. And so my central nervous system was waking me up in the night saying, you need to put attention to this project. And I really could not understand, why is it telling me that? Because my brain is telling me that this is fun and it's going well and the feedback's great. So the next morning I actually got up and I record my time, you know, as a consultant, like I used to do as a lawyer, really. And I need to look at this. There's something there. My central nervous system is definitely trying to tell me something. I don't know what it is. So I went through all my time. And what I found, which blew me away, was that I'd already exceeded the whole amount of time that the project was based on. And we're about two-thirds of the way through. Mm. Okay? Mm. Now, as a result of that, I actually contacted the company and just explained that to them. I said, I'm not looking for an uplift in fees, but I actually need to probably be a bit more efficient with my time. And they, very good people, came back and said, no. We'll review the retainer and we'll get it back on track. So there will be an uplift. Now, to me, that was a classic example there. Like, my brain was not telling me there's a problem here, but I was waking up in the night worrying about something that, and that is how it came about. So in teams, often there's people can't put their finger on exactly something's not quite right. And for me, I've learned is to not dismiss it and not try and come with some quick artificial answer to that question, and just to play it out a little bit and trying to do everything you can to work out what is actually underlying it.
Yeah, I mean, like, you literally woke up because you, like, that yep. was a wake-up call for you. I even think, like, just a silly analogy, but even like my dogs are barking, you're like, oh, it's just them barking. But then you think, no, actually there's a signal that they want me to go and see something. There's someone at the door or something is going on. There's an animal that might be a threat to them. It's like just paying attention to that.
Relationships, sometimes you just know within relationships that this doesn't feel quite right.
Yeah,
there's a bit of tension or something sitting there. I don't know why, but I suppose what I'm saying is it's dangerous, particularly in a performance environment, or probably all parts of life, to dismiss it. And also, I suppose what I'm saying is I don't trust my first cognitive answer to what is going on, because often it can be they're being unreasonable or whatever. Okay, something that suits me. It's an area I want to learn a lot more about, but I think in the next 10, 15 years, we are going to have a completely different understanding of all this stuff.
Yeah. I'll pop a few great articles and things that I'm reading in the show notes for this one, because there's such a focus on personal resilience as well at the moment, like, oh, just breathe through it, or like, be stronger, and just, you know, there's that kind of narrative as well, but it's like, hang on, maybe this is a signal. A book I want to mention just is Leap of Perception by Penny Pierce. So at the moment I'm doing an exercise where I'm paying attention to all my different senses, like smell, sight, sound, and then just figuring out which ones are strong for me and making note of what I'm feeling. It's been pretty powerful, actually, just to do that. So I'll put that in the show.
I'm glad you mentioned resilience too. Because
okay, what's that?
Because I don't believe that it's some magical character trait that people either have or don't have. I believe that I know my resilience is a direct reflection on whatever environment I'm in. If I'm with people who care about me and I care about them, if we've got some sort of shared identity and pursuing some endeavor together, if there's some psychological safety in that environment, if this doesn't work out well, then I'll be okay. Of all those things, I will feel resilient. I'll be quite strong. But if I'm in an environment where I don't feel I belong, I don't feel it's psychologically safe, I feel like if this doesn't go well, someone will pay a price. And if I'm the guy in the headlights, and it'll be me, and I'll be rejected, and punished, whatever, then I'm not going to feel resilient at all. So I really don't like how people sort of stand back and say, oh, yeah, I'm just trying to work out the resilience of these people. I don't think they're very resilient. Like, to me, that's nonsense.
Well, it's
just
think
about our environment first.
Environment, exactly, the dynamics, like the context, there's so much that sort of comes into it, as opposed to it being, you must be more resilient, like do more mindfulness. I really don't like that narrative either. So it's good that you called that out. Oh, we might end with the rapid round, if that's okay with you. Just a few quick questions for you. What is a book that has shaped the way that you think?
The first book really that lit my fire when it comes to performance coaching and culture was Sacred Hoops by Phil Jackson, the NBA coach. And the thing I love about this, he's written a few books. He's an amazing coach and a great writer. But Sacred Hoops was actually written between the first three Chicago Bulls titles and the last three. So, you know, it wasn't an older man reflecting back and all that. It was right in the middle of it. And it was and it's really, really powerful about how he, the alpha, Michael Jordan, how he managed him, how he got him to go team first, which hadn't been the way he'd played. How he also used some sacred ideas from Native American Indian tribes in his coaching. So, you know, there's a real reflect, you know, I mirror that approach myself, but I don't still think I've read anyone else. And that was just about the first book I read in this area. Wow. In the 1990s, which is so similar to the way I approach these things. So that still is my favourite performance book and culture book, probably.
Yeah, I mean, I love The Last Dance. I've watched a couple of times. Actually, even when I'm watching it, then I go onto YouTube and watch like the Lakers-Bulls game in full. And just because it's such a great, it's really fun to watch the, you know, the recording. I mean, you know the result, but it's even nicer just to rewatch it and see how great the team was, rather than just the highlights reel. Is there a favorite app or tool that you think we should all download, or are you anti-tech?
No, I'm not anti-tech, but I'm not. But a challenge I have is my two young children, well, 14 and 9, screen time. And so I'm not going to suggest an app, because I actually am trying to do better at role modeling, not spending too much time on screen. So I'm getting better at it, and having some real times with absolutely no screens around me, because otherwise I'm a bit of a hypocrite trying to challenge them. And so, yeah, I'd rather probably make that point than promote an app.
That's good. Yeah, I need that message actually directly, so thank you. What's a song that gets you sort of interstate, maybe not fired up, but just gets you focused and feeling good?
My favourite singer-songwriter is Bruce Springsteen. And I think what's amazing about him was that I grew up listening to him in the 1980s in New Zealand, and he I could have sworn he was talking about the town I grew up in. He's actually talking about these towns in New Jersey. But so one of his songs, My Hometown, is a beautiful story about belonging, really. You know, that, and you know, the idea of the boy sitting on his father's knee in the, you know, as they're driving around this, and his father telling him, this is our hometown. That is beautiful. Yeah. And that's just what a wonderful sense of belonging that is. And probably more poignant for me, because my father died when I was 5 and didn't get to probably have that type of experience. But yeah, Mike, it's lovely actually. My kids, my daughter, they all know the words to his songs. We sing them in the car. He's a quite an important part of our time.
Yeah, it's amazing how you can connect with someone that just through their art, that just means so much and stirs up such emotion. Finally, a favourite quote that you live by?
Well, this quote comes from my mother. And this is all about being grounded. And so her quote to me as a kid and continues now, and she's in her 80s, is never judge a day at lunchtime.
Oh.
So I'd come home and say, hey, it's amazing. I got made a prefect, or I've won the first 15 or whatever. And she'd say, that's good. But hey, never judge a day at lunchtime.
Oh my gosh. That's so funny you say that. I was driving around today and I'm like, I've got a reason. I think it was like 1 o'clock this afternoon. I'm like, I've got like just in my car because I'm not feeling the best. And I'm like, I'm just gonna restart this day again. So that's quite good that you say that. It's possible to either, you know, make a difference, like after lunch. Great quote. Thank you. I could talk I've got so many more questions for you, but I'd love to share your book. We'll put it into the show notes for this one. If any listeners would love to connect with you, where should we send them?
Well, I mainly LinkedIn, actually. That's where I, on social media, that's where I take a look at, and I'll post things occasionally, not a lot of it, but yeah, that's probably the best place.
Amazing. Thank you so much for your excellent work. We'll put a link to your LinkedIn profile, and congratulations on everything you've done and put together in this book. It's truly remarkable. Thanks, Owen.
Well, I appreciate you very much. Thank you.
You're the best. Thank you so much for tuning in to Work and Live Large. I really appreciate you. If you know someone in your network and you think, oh my gosh, they've got so much potential, like I want them to live and work larger, send them this episode. I think they might appreciate it. I also appreciate hearing from you, your feedback, your thoughts, your questions, anything. You can shoot me an email, hello@leannehughes.com, or find me on LinkedIn, just search for Leanne Hughes. Stay up to date with all the episodes by heading on over to leannehughes.com/subscribe, and all the best with your week as you go around living it up.